We had been discussing, I wanted to elaborate on the theme a little bit more. It was a little bit of a tangent, but so be it. I like tangents. The pasuk said by Ishtachu that David bowed. Let's get the exact wording. By Ishtachu Hamelech al Hamishkav. And the Mefarshim point out the similarity by Ishtachu Yaakov al Rosh Hamita. And Yaakov, at that time, when he asked Yosef to swear, and Yosef agreed to swear, realized that Yosef was retained his great tzidkus despite the temptations of being separated from his family and in a foreign environment from the age of 18, and despite the temptation of being a king. We discussed a little bit why Yaakov made Yosef swear, and we mentioned the concept that emerges from the Ramban, that although Yosef was completely committed and dedicated and devoted to keeping his word to his father, but once he swore and had a shvua, it would give him a greater energy and greater capacity. This increased motivation would actually increase his capacity. And he might reach an obstacle which would have stopped him because it was impossible for him to overcome that obstacle. But if you have additional driving force behind you, additional motivation, somehow you can muster more strength. And this idea that a person's capacity can expand is brought out by other chazals as well. I'd like to elaborate a little bit because to see different aspects of it. Chazal tell us, here we're talking about in the case of Yosef, the shvua, the fact that he swore and made a deeper commitment creates a deeper power and a deeper motivation. There are other forces as well that can serve a similar purpose. Chazal tell us, Ilu Yada Ruvain, if Ruvain would have known that the Torah was going to write, Vayatzileu Miyado, when the brothers were discussing the fate of Yosef and came to the conclusion that they would kill him, so Ruvain said, let's not kill him biyadayim, let's not kill him overtly, put him in the boar, and he'll die by himself. And Reuven's intention was to come back later when they weren't looking and rescue Yosef. It didn't quite work out that way. Before Reuven ever came back, they ended up selling him. But he did, in a sense, save him, because if Reuven would not have made that suggestion, they would have killed him on the spot. He wouldn't have been sold either. So it was kind of what you might say a half-baked rescue operation, you know, with mixed results. But the Torah calls it Vayatzileu Miyada, that he saved him. Says Chazal, if Reuven would have known that the Torah was going to write this down and record for posterity that he saved Yosef, he would have carried Yosef on his shoulders back to Yaakov. That's what the Chazal say. And a similar, in the same Medrash, says a similar thing by Aaron. It says that Moshe was afraid that Aaron would be insulted, that he was overlooked, and his younger brother became the leader. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "V'racha v'samach b'libo." When he sees you, he'll rejoice in his heart. It says, "Ilu yada Aaron." If Aaron would have known that the Torah was going to write "V'racha v'samach b'libo," he would have come out b'supim u'mecholot. He would have had a band. He would have been dancing, coming out to meet him. And the question is, and by Boaz also a similar idea. The question is, what's going on? Why, if Reuven would have carried him on his shoulders, if he knew that the Torah wrote it, Reuven would have carried him on his shoulders, why didn't he do it anyway? What was stopping Reuven from doing that now? If it was such a great idea to come out with Supim and Mechalos, why didn't Aaron do it anyway? Presumably, the reason why Reuven didn't do it is because he thought it was too dangerous. He had nine brothers against one. If he tries to take Yosef, they would fight him, and he would lose, and they'd kill him, and he wouldn't accomplish anything. But he had a plan. You know, listen, put him in the boar. That they would agree to, and they did agree to. And then, on his own, when they're not looking, he could bring him back, and he'll deal with his brothers later. If there was anything insincere about Reuven's motives, the Torah would have never said Vayatzileu Miyada. They wouldn't have been praised. Aaron didn't come out with a brass band because it's not normal. You're coming out to greet your brother. He's very happy. It never occurred to him that to make a party. But if there was anything lacking in the simcha in Aaron's heart, then why would the Torah praise him? B'samach b'libo. So the pshat is that if you would realize how valuable, it's not that somehow, you know, by us, it's not such a, you, I heard somebody saying, what's the chiddush? By us, it wouldn't be a chiddush, because we're not so sincere. So a person is doing something with not pure motives, you know, if you get a little covered, it motivates you to do something more. But Aaron and Cohen's motives were pure. The Torah doesn't praise insincerity. Reuven's motives were pure. The Torah doesn't give credit for insincere actions. So if he was completely motivated and completely pure, then why didn't he do it? Because he couldn't. So what would change if he knew that the Torah would write it? But the pshat is, if he knew that the Torah would write it and realize how precious, how valuable it is, that it will be recorded for all eternity for a lesson for mankind, this is how chashuv it is, you would muster up more inner strength. So just as we said, when a person feels more obligated because he has a shvuah, he musters up more strength. When a person understands the value of what he's doing in a deeper level, he can muster up more strength and become a stronger person and be able to accomplish things that he thought he couldn't accomplish, and he really couldn't, because in his state of mind he couldn't get beyond that. There's another chazal which most people are familiar at least with part of it, and I like to say this over because this is a great example of the type of thing that we hear as a story as a child and everyone's familiar with, and often we don't get past the child's understanding. And many, many, many people know this Gemara and don't really know what it's saying. Gemara says as follows. In the heavenly court, people are going to be brought up to judgment. It says, Hillel mechayev es ha'aniyim. Hillel will obligate the poor people. Rabbi Elazar ben Charsom mechayev es ha'ashirim. Rabbi Elazar ben Charsom will obligate the rich people. V'yosef mechayev es ha'rishayim. And Yosef will be mechayev the wicked people, which we see from the context of the Gemara means people who were particularly good looking, handsome or beautiful, and therefore had great temptations for arayos, because everyone was interested in them, and they succumbed. So Yosef will be mechayev them. And it goes on to tell the famous story of Hillel. Hillel was very, very poor and used to chop wood, and he would sell the wood, and half the money he would use to support his household, and half he would pay admission to the yeshiva. Derech Agav, a few observations I note. Number one, you know, there's been a lot of publicity recently about people complaining about the high cost of tuition, and it's a very serious problem. I'm not minimizing it. Tuitions are very expensive, especially people who are blessed with a number of children, and it's a big, big struggle. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware people are talking about this, talking about that. Bottom line, in the end of the day, with all the struggle and all the difficulty, people do it. Tremendous mesiras nefesh. And certainly in the frum community, people do what it takes. And, you know, work extra hours, the wife gets a job, and they somehow manage, for the most part, to squeeze by. It's a tremendous mesiras nefesh. But it occurs to me, and I can't prove it, I just have a gut feeling, that if we would have the system today that they had in the time of Hillel, which is not that you pay your monthly tuition bill or quarterly tuition bill or whatever it is, but rather you pay a daily admission like you were going to a concert. You know, you had to pay the admission, pay the ticket. I bet people wouldn't go. You have to pay as you go. Each time you have to reach in your pocket, pay again. Today, I don't know, it's tight. I'm not coming today. Yeah, I missed today. I can miss tomorrow. You know, people wouldn't do it. I think it's much harder to pay each day when you have to enter than it is to, so to speak, have a bill. But that's the system they had. Apparently there was greater chashivas of Torah, they could get away with that system. They apparently didn't charge a whole lot. That's the difference. But Hill didn't have a whole lot, and he used to pay. Second observation is that Gemara says, what was the money used for that they paid? In essence, it says to pay the shomer, basically the janitor, the watchman, the janitor for the yeshiva. Maybe they had to buy wood, you know, to heat their furnace. There wasn't really much expense. There were no salaries. There were no school books. There was, you know, it was no expenses. No insurance. So, in essence, the money was being used to pay the salary of a janitor. I don't know if they had two janitors. I don't know what they had. A little bit here and there. Hillel was not the only guy going to this yeshiva. Shemaya and Avtalion, the Gedolia Dor, were the rest yeshivas. They must have had an audience. So I don't know the exact numbers. The Gemara doesn't say. Is it reasonable to assume 100 people attended the yeshiva? If that's the case, that means the salary of the janitor of the yeshiva was maybe 50 times what Hillel was living on. If you say, when the Gemara says half, it doesn't mean literally half. Sometimes, you know, chatzi matzah is used to mean a portion. So maybe the ratio was lower. 10 times, 20 times, who knows? But it's quite a bit more. Now, the janitor, I doubt, was the richest fellow in town, and he didn't have the highest salary. So you could imagine what kind of poverty Hillel was living in if his take-home pay, so to speak, was maybe a 20th or a 30th at best of what the janitor in the yeshiva was making. So Hillel lived in dire poverty, and of course you know the story. One day, it was a Friday, he didn't find anybody to buy his wood. They wouldn't let him into the Beis Medrash. He climbed up onto the roof, listened to the skylight, the snow fell, he passed out. The next day they brought him down and they revived him, and they lit a fire, warmed him up. Kedaihu Hillel Chalav Es HaShabbos. And then they made an exception for Hillel. If he doesn't have money, he's admitted to the Beis Medrash. So when an Ani comes up to Shemayim and says, I was so poor, I was desperate to make a parnasa and running around, they say, I didn't have time to learn Torah. So they say to him, were you any more poor than Hillel? And Hillel learned Torah, so now you're chayiv, you have to learn Torah too. Rav Elazar ben Charsum was a wealthy man, had huge tracts of land, cities and so on. And the system they used to have was for public works, you know, the roads and the bridges. There was a rotation. Everybody had to spend a certain amount of time working on public projects. That was a sort of a work tax. And he had a foreman who was in charge of getting the people to come and do the work. One day Rav Elazar ben Charsum was on the way to his Beis Medrash, and the foreman sees him and says, hey, you never did your turn. And he said, I'm going to the Beis Medrash. He says, no, you're not. You got to do your fair share. And he didn't want to, Rav Elazar ben Charsum didn't want to go. He started beating him, and then it came out, he said who he was, and he let him go. So say here, Rav Elazar ben Charsum, his foreman did not recognize him. How much time do you think he spent in the office? Because clearly he was learning all day, never, Kamat ever paid any attention to his business, and his own foreman didn't recognize him. So a rich person comes up to Shemayim and says, I had a lot of property, I was responsible, I had businesses to run. It took up a lot of time. So I didn't have time to learn Torah. They said, you didn't have any bigger businesses to run than Rav Elazar ben Charsum, and he found the time for Torah. And Yosef was a handsome person, and he was constantly being tempted by Ishas Potiphar, the wife of his master. And you can imagine there's a certain additional psychological temptation if you're a slave and your master's wife is the one who's tempting him day in, day out. And in the end he resisted and got thrown into jail for his resistance. So anybody who says, I was handsome and my Yetzer was Torah to me, I was being constantly tempted, were you tempted any more than Yosef? And therefore, Yosef is Mechayev Esarishayim. But the question is, and I heard this explanation from my own Rebbe, from Rav Henoch Leibowitz, but I've seen it in print, a number of other people were Mechayev into the same shot. The question is, what kind of an argument is this in the Beis Din Shamayla? The reason why we hear these stories about Hillel and about Elazar ben Charsum and about Yosef HaTzadik is because they're extraordinary. These are great people who reached great madrigas, and Hillel was able to do that. Do you expect the same thing from everybody else? Everybody else is supposed to be Hillel? So every person is judged according to their capacity. So there's a simple equation. An Ani comes up to Shemayim, there's one question. Could he have learned more than he did? If the answer is yes, despite his poverty, he had opportunities to learn more than he did, he's chayev without Hillel. If the answer is no, he did the best he could, he's pater even with Hillel. So how is Hillel mechayev es aniyim? And how is Rav Elazar ben Charsum mechayev es ashirim? And Yosef mechayev es rishayim? Mimanashach. If you had the capacity to do better, then you should be chayev on your own. And if you deny the capacity to do better, then you should be pater even after these great people. And the explanation apparently is that without Hillel, a person could come up to Beis Din Shamayla and say, I'm Patur, I did the best I could. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yodea Talumos, Bochein Levu Kloyos, knows that it's not a phony answer, he did do the best that he could. But after hearing the story of Hillel and being inspired and seeing what a human being could do, that inspiration raises your level. And now there could be a tefillah on you for things that there would not have been a claim against you without Hillel. And the same thing for Elazar ben Charsim and Yosef HaTzadik. So the idea, hearing these inspirations, seeing what other people have achieved, that also could increase your capacity. So we human beings are not a fixed machine. We're not born with certain powers and we're trapped by those powers. There are ways and means and opportunities to become greater and greater and to expand geometrically. And by the way, this applies in surprising areas. We would think, okay, it applies in areas of effort, tzidkus. It even applies in intellectual areas. You know, we make a bracha every day in Shemoneh Esrei, Chonin Adas. We don't make brachas for Nisim. So why are we asking a Kaddish Baruch Hu to give us Das? You have a certain IQ and that's what you have. But apparently Das, understanding, intelligence also changes. And a person could be motivated and push harder and become smarter. I don't know if it's measured in IQ or not, but his capacity expands. And I'll tell you just a little story. We once had a student when I was in Manal in Florida. And that class, we had a somewhat large class, and we were able to split the class into two groups, a stronger group and a weaker group. And there was one boy, we'll call him Plony, was in the weaker group, and I was the one who divided up the groups based on the reports and my interviews and the tests and so on, and I would have placed him pretty much in the middle of the weaker, not at the top of the weaker group, but someplace in the middle. When he was in ninth grade, his ninth grade Rebbe was coming to me and telling me I should move him up into the stronger group. I didn't really believe him. Because why? This kid was a wonderful kid. Derech Eretz, used to try very hard, very cooperative. And I know there's a tendency, a teacher, when they have such a cooperative student, they tend to build him up. They think he's great. But it doesn't necessarily address the academics. This is especially true with a Rebbe, because a Rebbe is concerned with more than academics. A Rebbe is concerned with developing the mention, and he's getting nachas from this kid. He's about derech eretz. It's especially true with a Rebbe who's teaching a weaker class, because in a weaker class, there often is a higher proportion of people who are not motivated, either because they've given up, or maybe the reason they were in the weaker class to begin with is because they weren't motivated. So when you get a kid who is motivated and trying, he stands out. But it doesn't mean that he could hold his own on the higher level. But I didn't really want to say this to the Rebbe. I didn't trust him, you know, his judgment. So, you know, I used the technique, you know, like the Gemara says, Ishtamute kam ishtamet. I never said yes, I never said no, but somehow it didn't get done. So after a while of this, you know, he was a smart fellow, this Rebbe, he caught on. And he says, listen, I know you find it hard to believe, so I have an idea. Why don't you give a bechina, fahir, to my whole shir, and you decide yourself what you think. So it's a good idea to give a bechina to the class anyway, and I figure, okay, I could get this guy off my case, we'll do it. So I took the kids in and questioned them on the Gemara. I took them two or three at a time, because I didn't have all day. But this kid I took in one-on-one. I didn't just question him, I grilled him. You know, he was answering the questions, getting the Gemara, I was twisting it backwards, forwards, this guy was solid. You know, it was no question, he was like miles ahead of everybody else in the shir. So I went back to him, I have to admit, you're right, we'll move him up. So we move him up into the higher shir. About 2 months later, I happened to speak to the Rebbe of the higher shir. I said, so how is Plony doing? Terrific. He's either the best or the second best guy in the shir, you know, neck and neck with so-and-so, who was a brilliant kid. I said, that can't be. Of course, I knew what Chazal say, but you still, you know, you don't see it in real life. And to me, this was a clear example. There was no other explanation. He wasn't naturally gifted, genius. Even his parents didn't think he was a genius. It must be that he wasn't a genius. Jewish parents would think their own kid is not a genius. And he ended up being one of the best guys in the higher share, and he did very well. So this is because his motivation increased his capacity. And therefore, people should, you should never really write anybody off, especially not ourselves. You never know how far we could go. Okay, getting back to Malachim. So up to Pasuk Memches. The Gam Kocha Omar HaMelech. Alright, so reorient ourselves, this is the report of Yonatan ben Eviasar, who is trying to, as we pointed out, not mention anything unnecessarily to cause pain to Adonio and to his father, but to give all the relevant information necessary to make sure that they know how serious the situation is and they take proper action. So he's explained how there was a public anointment of Shlomo, how the people supported it, how it was with the king's consent, and not just with the king's consent, but a reluctant consent, but enthusiastic consent. And here you see how they gave the bracha that Shlomo should be better, and how David acknowledged that bracha and bowed down. And now he adds, "V'gam kocha amar melech," and this is also what the king said, and this detail also is not mentioned in the first round of the story. Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael, blessed is Hashem, the God of Israel, Hashem Nosan Hayom Yoshev Al Kisi, that has put somebody sitting in my throne today, the Eini Ro'os, and my eyes have seen it, that I live to see my successor taking over the throne. What exactly is this adding to the message of Yonatan? It could be that it's just here to reinforce the idea that David really wants it, that he thanked Hashem, and this is what he said, and therefore that there's no chance of changing David's mind, and no chance of thinking that, you know, you could recover. Mefarshim point out also that there's another little nuance that's added in this pasuk, and that is, Hu Yoshev Al Kisi. If you recall, we had a similar mashmos earlier when Bathsheba was addressing David. And she used the expression Yeshev Al Kisa, to sit on your throne, and that implied that Shlomo's throne should be as secure as your throne. David at this time had pretty absolute power over all of Kal Yisrael, and in fact Israel was the strongest country in the world at the time. So this is the implication that David is saying, he should sit on my throne. Perhaps Adonio was harboring the ambition, the belief, the possibility, the hope that maybe the kingdom would be divided somehow, be weakened somehow. Okay, Shlomo will be king, but maybe I could get my following. I'll have my own section. So this message here is that David was fully behind Shlomo having absolute control, kingdom over everything. He wasn't ready to divide it up and give Adonio his piece of the pie. We see, by the way, for this whole speech of Yonatan, something which I think we probably have all come across in real life. When people get fixed on a certain goal or a certain accomplishment, and it becomes apparent that it's not going to work, they often grasp at straws. You know, they have this feeling, oh, I could do it this way, I'll try it that way. Some people just give up, but some people grasp at straws. This is a pretty remote argument. Right, Adonio already has heard that they made this public spectacle of anointing Shlomo as king. He's got the Sanhedrin, he's got Nasanat Navi, he's got Tzedek HaKohen. The people are all rejoicing and they're all behind it. It was with the express command of David HaMelech. David HaMelech is happy about it. Well, maybe he'll give me a piece too. Apparently, that's another, you know, we don't know whether Adonio thought that or not, but at least Yonatan thought that he might, and therefore added this expression, even though he left out certain other things, because that's human nature. It's possible that people will grasp at straws. You know, sometimes you'll see, like there's a, you know, recently we had a presidential election that was very close, but you go back, not every election is so close. I remember there was an election where Bob Dole was running against Clinton, I think it was. And like a couple of weeks, a week or two before the election, he was like 12 points behind in the polls. And, you know, there are people still out there, well, you know, there's still a week and this could happen and that could happen. Ain't nothing going to happen. it's hard to know in these cases what they really believe. Some of it is just a show. You have to say it anyway. But you certainly get the sense that the people who are caught up in the campaign still think that they have a chance. And this is the mentality. You're pushing, you're driving. It's very hard for a person to give up on his dream. So they grasp at straws. You know, this could happen, that could happen. So therefore, Yonatan found it necessary to add this additional thrust. So what happened? This is something probably, unfortunately, we probably also came across in real life. Vayecherdu, everyone was afraid. Vayakumu kol hakruim asher Daniel. All the people were invited to Daniel got up. Vayelchu yisadak, everyone went on his own way. Nobody here. They all abandoned him. There's a little bit of an indication here that perhaps the people invited to this party were not so innocent either. We had pointed out before that Adonio was clearly not innocent because he had a very selective invitation list, and we see who he left out and so on. But it could be the other members of the party at least shared some guilt, or maybe they were just afraid that they would be caught up in it, but they all left. Fair weather friends. This is not unprecedented. First of all, David HaMelech himself faced a similar situation. Don't think it's only people who are doing an Avera, doing a Chet, doing something improper that get abandoned. When Avshalom rebelled against David, and Avshalom temporarily gained the upper hand, and David had to run away, not too many people came to join David. And plenty of people also faded away into the background. You know, we don't know if they were with Avshalom, but they stayed out. Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron came to see Paro for the first time, and they came with the Zakenim. But what happened between leaving Goshen and arriving at the palace of Paro? They all left. Moshe and Aaron went alone. It's human nature. Not everyone is as motivated. Not everyone has the Mesirus Nefesh. You know, people's friendships sometimes only go so far. True friendships are really very rare. That people would go so far and stick their own neck out, not so simple, not so easy. And there's an important message in that. The message in that is, you know, if we are ever on the victim end of such a situation, not to get so upset at the people who have abandoned you. This is human nature, it's a weakness, I'm not condoning it, but we have to understand that that's the way people are, and people shouldn't get overly upset over it. And ultimately, if a person is properly motivated, it shouldn't make a difference to him. And it's not so easy, easier said than done. I recall experience I had when I was on my way to Miami, and a few days before I left, I went to see the Rosh Yeshiva to say goodbye, and he told me, by the way, you know, if you're going to Miami to help the community there, you think you're doing them a favor, I recommend that you should not go. So you're not doing this for them, you're doing it for yourself. So my initial thought was, I wish he would have told me this before I hired the moving truck. Then my second thought was, what do you mean? I thought I was doing it for them. I don't need this. So I didn't say anything about the moving truck, but I did say something about that. And he explained, of course you're there to help them. But the reason why you're helping them is because it's the right thing for you to do. So that means it's your Avodas Hashem. So you're not dependent on their gratitude. Sometimes you're going to help a person and go out of your way to do for that person, and then the guy's going to turn around and stab you in the back. And then you're going to be upset, why did I help him? And you're going to have charata over the mitzvah that you did. And that's a terrible thing. He says, you're not helping him so he should be helped and he should be grateful to you. He says, if he needs the help, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could send him the help without you. It's because you're in a position to do it, and therefore it's the right thing for you to do. So then you're doing it for that reason. So who cares whether he thanks you or not? Who cares whether he works with you or against you? But don't be dependent on the gratitude of other people. Realize that that it's for your benefit. That's what you're doing. Now, the fact of the matter is, it's very hard to persevere in life without a little bit of gratitude from other people, a little bit of support. We need chizuk. And you get it. Don't think everybody turns around and stabs you in the back and nobody expresses any gratitude. But you do run across those situations. And if you have this attitude, to the extent that you could have that attitude, to that extent you will be somewhat immunized against this type of reaction. So people abandon you. I'm doing it because it was the right thing to do. In this case, it was the wrong thing to do. But if it is the right thing to do, I'm doing it for that reason. And therefore you can handle those setbacks. And the chizuk, hopefully you get here and there too. I guess on the highest madrigas, perhaps a person can manage without that chizuk. But most of us, I think, require it. But at least we can minimize that dependency. And we don't give up just because other people don't react. They react with their human weaknesses. So Adoniyahu is left alone. And Adoniyahu is a little bit nervous himself. So Adoniyahu yorei mipnei Shlomo. Adoniyahu was afraid from before Shlomo. Vayokam vayelch, he got and he went. Vayachazek bekarnos hamizbeach, and he held on to the corners of the mizbeach. This is going to become a popular mode, but exactly what that does for you is highly questionable. But before we get to that, there's an interesting choice of words. It says Vayari mipnei Shlomo. Mefarshim point out that the expression mipnei indicates a certain superficialness. He didn't fear Shlomo. It doesn't say Vayari es Shlomo, but mipnei Shlomo, which means that Adoniyahu was not afraid of Shlomo because Shlomo was the king, because Shlomo deserved to be the king. I did something wrong. He was afraid, simply power politics. Shlomo is in charge now. Shlomo has the people behind him. He's got the army. He's got the crazy. He's got the placey. He's got everybody. I'm in trouble. So it was a political fear, but not a true fear. He never really abandoned his desire to be king. He realized that it was politically unwise. And of course, we will see this played out in the second parak, where Adoniyahu makes another effort to try to take over the throne. So Adoniyahu's fear was not tshuva. He did not really abandon his project. It was simply a pragmatic reaction to the very difficult situation that he found himself in. Now, this business of holding on to the karnos hamizbeach, there seems to be a machlokas, a different opinions as to what, if anything, it could accomplish. Some say that in essence it was a mistake, although Adoniyahu did it and Yoav did it, and they say it was based on the pasuk of Me'im Mizbechi Tikachel Amos, from with my Mizbeach, you take him to die, Me'im Mizbechi Velo Me'al Mizbechi. From near my Mizbeach, but not from on my Mizbeach. So if you're holding on to the karnos HaMizbeach, you're on the Mizbeach. However, according to many opinions, that pasuk only applies to a Kohen who is doing the Avodah. So a Kohen who is doing the Avodah and he's on the Mizbeach, so you can't do anything to him at that time, even if he's Chayiv Misa. But some non-Kohen who just goes on the Mizbeach, there is no such benefit. Others say that there is a din of a miklat, even for a commoner, for a non-Kohen going on to Mizbeach, but a miklat is a miklat. A miklat only works for a shogeg. A person who kills a person b'shogeg, you could go to Arei Miklat, to a city of refuge, and nobody could touch you, so you could sit on the Mizbeach and nobody could touch you. But if your crime was bemazed, was deliberate, there is no protection from the Mizbeach. So why did Adoniyahu do it? So again, it could be Adoniyahu made a mistake. But others suggest that Adoniyahu was aware of that too, and he wasn't relying on the halachic aspects of the Mizbeach, but the emotional ones. It's just not nice, you know, to kill somebody in the Mizbeach. The truth is, even the Goyish world has such a sensitivity. You know, somebody goes into a house of worship, You don't kill him there. The Arabs certainly don't have such a sensitivity, but others in the world do. So, halachically, Adoniel knew that, according to this opinion, that he was not really protected, but he thought it might be a deterrent to Shlomo if he wanted to kill him, that he wouldn't want to do it on the Mizbeach. At least he'll get a chance to try to talk his way out of it. Rashi adds an additional twist to this, and it's based on the Medrash Tanchuma, that Adoniel said, I assume he didn't say this to Shlomo. I assume it means he said to himself, that, listen, how long can I stay on the Mizbeach? Especially if they cut off food and water, electricity, air conditioning, how long can I be here? So Adoniel said, I'll be here till I die. But if I am executed by the king, I get buried with all the criminals. If I die a natural death, at least I could be buried in my family graveyard. So I'd rather die that way than the other way. He was prepared to wait until his own death. That indicates as well that this wasn't a true tshuva. Because if he's making cheshbonos, listen, all right, you're going to kill me, then I'd rather die this way. If there was a true tshuva, he would throw himself at the mercy of Shlomo. If I deserve to die, let me die. But if you have mercy on me, I'll be forgiven. But he did not, it wasn't a true tshuva. This was all calculations, what is the best political exit strategy for myself. Yes, David Melch was still alive. It was pretty clear that David was still alive. And there's some interesting implications of that in the following psukim, kind of previewing what's coming up. But this happened immediately because David was alive. He sent Shlomo to be anointed as king. Shlomo came back. David made the bracha. Later, we will see in the second parak, David gives instructions to Shlomo what to do after his death. So in between that, this was immediate. This was immediately upon hearing the news that Shlomo was appointed king. He ran to the Mizbeach. And this is when Adoniel is making his cheshbonos. That means David is still alive and Shlomo has been anointed king. And Shlomo is in that status we mentioned before. There are differing opinions whether Shlomo was really the king or just the king designate. That's when this took place. Now, so what does Adoniyahu say? So we don't have a direct report about Adoniyahu. It says we have the message that gets back to Shlomo. Pasuk Nun Aleph. Vayugad l'Shlomo Lemer was told to Shlomo saying, Hine Adoniyahu yorei et hamelach Shlomo. Adoniyahu is afraid of the king Shlomo. Vehine ochaz bekarnos hamizbeach Lemer, and he is holding onto the corners of the mizbeach saying, Yishavali chayom, let the king swear to me like day, Hamelach Shlomo, im yomis es avdo becharav, that he will not kill me by sword. Why is he asking for a shvua? So the Mefarshim explained that Adoniel was saying that if Shlomo were to say, I'm not going to kill you, Adoniel said, I still can't feel comfortable. Because at any given day, you may change your mind. So I can't live my life in constant fear. I'd rather die. But if you give me a shvua that you won't kill me, then I could be confident that you'll keep your shvua, and then I'm ready to leave. He thinks he's negotiating. He's not exactly in the best bargaining position. I'm not leaving unless you give me a shvua. But again, we see Adoniel's state of mind. He's angling for the best deal. This is not true hachna, true tshuva. In fact, we will see that Shlomo never gave him such a shvua. Shlomo called his bluff, and Adoniel left anyway. But Shlomo never gave him the shvua, and in fact didn't really completely accept his request. Okay. Vayomer Shlomo said, Im yiyeh leben chayil, if you will be a ben chayil. We keep on getting this expression and it's never very clear exactly what it means. If you'll be a ben chayil, lo yipol misaroso artsa, nothing will happen to you, not a hair will fall to the ground, meaning nothing will be done to you. Vim ra simatze bo, but if we find evil within you, v'meis. It's spoken in third person, derech kavod, that Daniel is sof kosov, a prince, the son of the king. So he's speaking to him derech kavod, in an honorable way, third person. If he does nothing wrong, then not a hair from his head will fall. And if he does something bad, he will die. A question can be raised, and I think we'll probably deal with it next week, was what exactly was Shlomo saying when he said, if ra timatze bo v'meis, the Metzudas explains that what he's saying was, if he does something wrong, even if that crime in and of itself is not worthy of dying, he's going to die anyway. And l'chora, the Metzudas explanation is muchach, must be so. Because if what David was saying is that if you do a crime that's guilty of death, you'll die, that's of course. Why? Why should a Daniel expect to have some kind of exemption? I could go commit crimes freely and nothing will happen to me. So there's no need to say that. He should have just said, Imiyele ben chayo, lo yipo misarata arza. So this expression clearly means that if you do something which in and of itself would not necessarily merit and warrant the death penalty, still, I'm going to kill you anyway. And the question is why? And that we'll have to wait for next week.